I've spoken on this before, and I want to kind of expand on some of the things I talked about before on suffering and trials. And certainly, I'm looking around here, and I think everybody's older than me in this congregation. And so you've gone through your fair of, well, except for my lovely wife, Carol, who I robbed the cradle, so she's definitely not old. But you've gone through your share of difficult times, I know, and I don't know everybody's situation in intimately. But as you can imagine, I've certainly reflected on suffering and pain over the past couple of years, as my wife has as well. And there's a reason it's called the problem of pain. In philosophical circles, they discuss this as a problem in the existence of God. Does God exist if there's so much pain in this world? I don't really want to look at it from a philosophical perspective necessarily, but there are many things that I believe that we can learn about this particular topic. And even on subjects that we know very well, there's always something that you don't know about it. And it seems like the more you delve in on a subject, the more questions you may have. And it opens up more avenues, and you say, well, I'm going to look explore this. And it can help you open up introspectively and look at things from a personal perspective as well. And I think it can be a truly difficult matter sometimes to understand. In some ways, I'm not sure that we'll ever understand it completely in this life. In this physical, temporal existence, there's only so many things that that we can get without, God says we see through a glass darkly. So there are certain things that we only understand in a temporal way or in a limited way. But it doesn't mean that there's no meaning for us. It doesn't mean that there's no purpose for this pain and this suffering that we all go through in this life. And I'd like to give you some of my reflections on this subject, and I've entitled this sermon Reflections on Suffering. Reflections on Suffering. I believe that often people take the wrong message away from suffering. There's certainly a different view depending on whether you're looking at a problem from the inside or a difficult situation from the inside or whether you're looking at it from the outside. Suffering is easier to handle from the outside as an academic exercise. You may say, well, A equals B and C equals A, therefore B equals C. That's the problem in a nutshell, and it's solved. Why does someone go through a painful situation? And many times it's easier to answer that from the sidelines, you know, to play armchair quarterback and to say, well, this is the problem. I mean, all you have to do is look at Job's friends in the book of Job. They came rushing to his aid, and they said, here's the problem. Bam, 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 bam. But that really wasn't it. But once you're in it, once you're in the suffering and the pain, it becomes different indeed, as you all are no doubt aware of the trials that you've gone through. So unless someone has gone through suffering, just as with most experiences, it simply is a case of academics for the most part. We can write equations about it. We can surmise the causes of it, and we can write books about it. We can fill each other with platitudes. When we don't know what to say to someone when they're going through something, you know, we'll say, well, it's always darkest before the dawn. It'll get better one day. You'll get over it eventually. You know, sometimes these things that we say don't necessarily make people feel better. Maybe they help our own comfort. Maybe they help us in our own discomfort of the situation because we don't really know how to handle it. But those are the things, you know, where we're just not aware of what people may be going through. You know, it's a gift to empathize with someone when they're going through a certain difficulty that you haven't experienced before. Empathy is feeling for somebody else without exactly knowing what their feelings are. You say, well, I empathize with you. I don't really know what you're going through, but you have some sort of a semblance, some similitude of what that feeling may be that they're going through. And that's a challenging thing. That's a gift, I think, to be able to do that. I think growing up, I had no idea what empathy was. For me, it was very regulated, I believe. And I thought of it as A equals B, C equals A, and B equals C. That's the way I kind of looked at a lot of things. And I remember specifically being in Disney World many years ago and seeing somebody, I don't remember what problem they had, but seeing they had a difficulty, and I remember thinking, oh, that's so sad. I hope that doesn't happen to me, and you go on. but there's no empathy there. But it's really extraordinary to be able to sympathize with someone when you've gone through something that they've gone through. Now, it may not be exactly the same thing, but sympathy is feeling the same feelings another is feeling because you've experienced it too. So when you can feel those feelings that they're going through, that is extraordinary. But that is something I think God wants us to do. It's something he wants us to pick up, to understand. In Hebrews chapter 4, and you go ahead and turn over there to Hebrews chapter 4, we see in Hebrews here that Jesus suffered and he was tempted, or he was tested, in every way that we are tested. Now, some say, well, he wasn't tested in ways of marriage or other ways of some temptations that we go through, maybe because of technology or whatever. But everything is repackaged. There's nothing new under the sun. When he came to this earthly vessel in the frailty of the human flesh, he lived the perfect life in a very imperfect realm. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15 says, "For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling," the sympatheo is the word, sympatheo, "of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin." You see, Jesus' compassion for us cannot be doubted, knowing that Jesus went through all possible areas of testing that we go through in our life. And as I said, there's nothing new under the sun, Solomon said. Everything is just repackaged in some way, shape, or form. And it's presented as it were new. But yet Jesus, knowing the frailty of this human frame and experiencing the same pulls and the tugs that we feel, he can intimately sympathize with us as we go through the same testing, the same temptations, the same trials. These are things that he experienced. And Jesus had the same feelings that we have. And these feelings, frankly, could range from excitement to sadness. It could be a whole range of emotions or feelings. But Paul, in this case, was specifically speaking of feeling our infirmities, of feeling our sufferings. It means that Christ knows the sadness, and he knows the pain, and he knows the heartache that comes with some suffering that you are going through. He didn't say, well, you should never have those feelings. He didn't say you should never be sad. He didn't say don't experience these. He went through them. Christ felt them and he knows what they're like. But the point is that he didn't let them overcome him to overwhelm him to the point of falling into sin. And that is the challenge. Because there are many things that can go through your mind when you're in a certain situation. And I'm telling you, and you all experience this, it is different from the outside than it is from the inside. You look at things very differently. And it really makes you feel for someone else who has gone through something. You know, when we're attuned to God communicating with us through his word, he will often give us the right scripture at just the right time. And there have been many times that I have read, and maybe you have as well, where you've read a certain scripture at a certain time in your life and it meant one thing to you, but then you opened the book up and you read it some other time when you were going through something and you said, you know what, I never thought about it that way. And it brought something else out. It's like looking at the gem of a diamond and you look at the different facets and it illuminates things in different ways and it brings different lights out and you can walk around it and you can see different things, but you wouldn't ever be able to see that, right? Unless you were going through that particular situation. You look at things in a different light. And I've said, my wife has opened up her Bible to read oftentimes, and she's told me this. And she just says, well, I'll open the book up and I'll just let it fall where it may and I'll just read. And she says so many times it is exactly what she needed to hear. It's what she needed to read at that particular point in her life. It is just exactly what she wanted, what she needed, and God is in that. So I believe the inner experience that we have will often qualify the academics, and it can really give us a little bit a better handle on suffering and pain with caveat, if we let it. But one of the questions that gets in our way with this challenging topic is the question, why? The question comes up, why? And oftentimes it's, why me? Why me? Why am I going through this particular problem? Why not somebody else? Not that you want someone else to go through it, but why is it me? And you want to know why. Well, I believe that we want to know why for a couple of reasons. I believe that we want to know why so that we can decide if the cause of the suffering is, number one, is it justified? We want to know why because we want to know if the cause is justified. And number two, we want to know if the cause of the problem is, or the pain, is fixable. We want to know those, in my mind, these two questions. We're typically conditioned to cause and effect. Well, if we do A and we do B and we do C, then the outcome will be D. It's garbage in, garbage out. Whatever the input is, you know, that will determine the output. And, you know, if we do that, And then the result is D. And if it doesn't, you know, come up that way, then we say, well, D was clearly wrong. Well, that was just completely wrong because we were clearly right. I mean, we're right, aren't we? We tend to always think we're right. And if somehow we were wrong, which we don't know how that could be possible, we can put some simple fix on it, just some simple thing we can tweak. And we may think of it in many different ways or terms. We may think, well, all I have to do is just maybe spend 5 more minutes in prayer. That's all I have to do. Or maybe I just need to read another page of my Bible. Or it's something that we think that we just have to do this one little thing and then God will say, okay, it's all gone. But we typically don't want to accept that we have any shortcomings. And when we're in a situation that challenges us, we feel that it's unjustified. We're always wanting to justify ourselves in practically anything we do, and that's why we ask the question, why? Why does this happen? Or why did this happen? Bill Cosby tells this humorous story, and he's told it in different ways, but he told this story on a recent A&E, Comedy Central, I believe, episode that he had, and he tells the story of a time when he drove his kids to school for the first time because his wife, I think, was not able to do it for whatever reason on that particular day. And when they had gotten about a block away from school in their automobile, his kids had asked him, "Hey, Dad, would you stop here and drop us off so we don't, you know, so we'll walk to school. It's just a block away. We'll walk to school." And of course, he stops and he leans back to him in the back seat and he says, "You know, why do you want me to stop here? What's going on?" And so he says, "Well, you know, to get to the truth of the matter," he says, "you pick on the weakest and the youngest." And he goes, "Judas?" Because he's going to betray them all. So after a lot of him and hawing, they finally told their dad that their friends we're going to give them a lot of grief when their mom would drop them off at school because their friends thought they were rich. They had a lot of money, so that they gave them a lot of problems about that. And they would harass them. And so, if they were seen walking to school, you see, their friends had a better opinion of them. So that's why they wanted to walk to school. They thought they could get their dad on this. And so after hearing this, Bill Cosby, said that he did a U-turn. He'd parked, you know, they talked about this, and they did a U-turn and drove away from the school about a half a mile. And they did another U-turn and pulled over to the edge, and he stopped, and he says, "Get out." He says, "Get out." And they looked at him and said, "What, Dad, what are you doing? We're like a half a mile from school." And he says, "Yeah." He says, "Just think about what your friends will think of you now that you walk further." And so, reluctantly, they got out, and Bill Cosby did another U-turn, and as he drove away, he was looking in his mirror, is what he said, and then he said he saw his kids nearly come to blows as they were acting out on each other after being dropped so far away from school because they thought it wasn't fair. It wasn't right. Why did he do that to us? We didn't deserve this. Why are we here? Why do we have to walk so far? And so after seeing this, he drove around. And I'll tell you the rest of the story in just a minute, but I thought about this particular situation, and do you know that God could drive us up to the school and drop us off? I mean, he could do that. He could drop us right off at the school. But sometimes in order to see how we'll react, he'll drop us, you know, a half a mile away. And he'll tell us to walk from here. And as he drives away, we stand there complaining and wondering and contemplating and justifying and feeling hurt, and we feel alone, and we wonder, why are we in this particular situation? We don't deserve this. When really all we need to do is just turn and just start walking. We just need to start walking. Now, Bill Cosby's kids didn't really get that until much later in life, but in this particular case, as he turned around, he came back to his kids and he picked them up where he had dropped them off a half a mile before the school, and he said, go ahead and get in the car. And let's see, Bill Cosby, he went to the school, if I remember right, and he said he dropped them off in front of the school, and as he dropped them off, he said, let me remind you of something, kids. He said, you don't have a lot of money and you're not rich. He said, your mother and I are rich. He says, when you need money, you come to me. When you need food, you come to me. Your name is not on the mortgage of the house. You don't pay for the bills. He said, you don't have any money. So, you know, don't worry about what your friends will think of you. He said, you're poor. You're very poor. And what he says, you're really homeless. And he says, the only reason that we take care of you is because the state tells us to. And he said one last thing before they stepped out of their vehicle. He said, and by the way, he said, your friends are much richer than you. He said, look at them. He said, they're stepping off a $300,000 bus. You know, clearly there are degrees of suffering. These kids thought they were suffering that day. I remember doing this with my mom, and I remember going to the airport to fly out to see my dad. And she would often hug me before security and all that sort of stuff. You go to the gate and everything. And she would hug me, and I felt so embarrassed as an 8 or 9 year old, I think. And I remember one year we were getting ready to get out of the car, and I said, Mom, could you hug me here in the car? I didn't want to be hugged there by the gate. It was too embarrassing. That was my suffering at the time. But it seems that none of them are very easy that we go through. Suffering is challenging. It's challenging physically, and it's challenging spiritually. But when we look at suffering and we say, for instance, we say, well, God didn't figure actively in suffering. And we say, well, God just allows this to occur or allows it to happen. And then he makes beauty out of the ashes. Is in some ways, I think, is creating an escape for God. Now, it's not always. I think there are things that happen and God allows those things to work out. But we don't want to make an escape. What I mean to say is that God didn't, let's say, look away from us as we were doing something and then look back and say, oops, oh, I didn't realize that. Don't worry about that, though. I'll take care of it. I'm going to make beauty out of it. That's what I'm talking about. It wasn't an oops moment. What did you say? Oops? No, he didn't say oops on us. But God does make beauty out of ashes, but he doesn't need an escape route for us either to try and figure this out. Of course, let me just clarify that God generally, of course, does not have an intimate role in the life of sinners. We know this. We know that the sins of individuals or people have separated themselves from God, that God said, he says, I will not hear you, he says to Israel. And we know that time and chance can happen to them all. He tells us that the rain falls on the just and the unjust, and the towers of Siloam didn't fall on the men just because they were any more wicked than the others. But when we look at God's chosen closely, God's hand is actively involved in our lives. Turn to Romans chapter 8, if you would. Romans chapter 8. God takes an active role in our lives. And sometimes it seems as he's not there. But I think of that old footprint poem where sometimes it says that he looks back and he saw in the difficult times of his life one set of footprints as if he was the only one walking. And what God says is in this poem, he says, no, those were the times that I carried you. Those were my footprints. And so in Romans 8, chapter 8 and verse 28, we read that Paul wrote, and we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. Joseph said to his brothers when they came to Egypt, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. Brethren, have you ever taken something apart and put it back together again only to find that you have some leftover screws? Maybe some bolts there, maybe a nut, could be a washer, and you're really not sure where the whole thing, all of it goes. I've done that many times. Try to take apart my wife's computer, which is that one right there, because something was wrong. It didn't turn out to be anything on the inside. But as I pulled that thing apart and I put it back together, I had some screws left over. I don't know where these things go. I did this on an engine one time. That was a big mistake. I'm sure you all know this. I think we've all done stuff like this. But you see, when God puts the pieces of our life together, and he takes all our experiences, and he weaves our experiences together into a beautiful tapestry, there are no leftover pieces. He doesn't say, well, I don't know where to put this thing. We'll just discard that. No, everything that we do, he will use to build this beautiful tapestry for him. He uses every piece to build his masterpiece. But God making all things work together has to be only part of the picture if it's not to detract from who God is and to make him weak, limited, or wishy-washy in some way. We know that God is all-knowing, he's all-powerful, and he's all-loving. And if he can't protect me from suffering, but he rather turns it around and he uses it for my good, somewhat like the good fairy in Sleeping Beauty who couldn't remove the curse of the evil fairy and so turn the threat of death into this deep sleep, then the question is, he isn't really all-powerful or all-knowing, is he? On the other hand, to say, yes, God can keep me from suffering, but just doesn't choose to, means that he isn't all-loving, right? Well, I would say no on both accounts. There's some qualifications that have to take place in this. No on both questions, because although God is powerful enough to prevent suffering, when he allows it, and it's not just a matter of turning his head and saying, oops, when he looks back, but when he purposefully allows it, there is a compelling and an active reason for that to occur. There is a compelling and an active reason. And there really can be no other reason, brethren. There is a compelling and active reason for this happening in your life and in my life. And if you remember nothing else, I want you to remember that. Because that shows God as an all-loving and all-powerful God. It will help us through the darkest days. Mr. Barnett had talked about perfection that God seeks, and he quoted some scriptures. And God does seek perfection. He says, I'm holy, therefore you be holy. He wants us to have the perfection of the holiness that he has. And that means, the means to that perfection, I should say, is sometimes very difficult to understand. How do we get to that perfection? What is God doing to get us there? I remember when I was in high school and I was running track. I did track all through high school. And our coach would have us run intervals. And I was a sprinter for the most part. Ran the 1, 2, and 400. And my best races were the 2 and 400, closer to the intermediates. But he would have us run over and over and over again with specified rest times in between. Now, at the time, I didn't really understand it. I just knew that you know, this is what we were to do to get better. But there are often times that many of us, including myself, we'd throw up at the end of a run. It was just horrible aching pain. And your muscles would burn. They would just sting because of the lactic acid buildup or the fatigue. Why am I doing this to myself? This is horrible pain that I'm putting myself through. But the ones who were on the higher level understood it to a level, to an extent that I didn't really understand it. And so oftentimes, I didn't put the effort into practice that I should have done. And I look back on those days and I regret not putting the effort in. In fact, many times in practice, I remember one guy that would often beat me in practice, but when we went to the races, didn't put the effort in. I just thought, well, I've got the talent. In many ways, I had that level of talent that I could do that. But going up against the best, you know, I would have to push myself further. But I remember specifically sitting on the bleachers of our coach, and he was retiring. He was an older coach, and I had broken the school record in the 400 meter. And I said, Coach, I'm going to break 50 next year in the 400. And he said, I don't think you will. I said, what? I said, I was 50.4. How can I not break 50? It's unbelievable. No, I don't think you will. I said, okay, I'll prove it to you. And you know, I didn't break 50 that year. And I didn't figure this out for several years, why he knew I wouldn't break 50. Because he saw my work ethic in practice. And he didn't see I put in the effort and the practice and work hard to achieve the next level. He knew what it took to get me there, but I didn't accept it. So, you know, God, knowing all these things, knows the direction that He needs to take us to get us there. And sometimes we tend to be resistant to those things because we don't understand it. We like to sit there and instead of running, we like to say, why are you doing this to me? What's going on? I don't deserve this. We just need to get up and go. You know, we could turn to Job to see the active hand that God had in his suffering, but I want to rather turn to Exodus chapter 17, and I'd like you to turn over there. I want to look at a particular story here, a particular episode of the children of Israel as they had left Egypt shortly before this. And I want to just read through a good chunk of this, and then we'll discuss it. But Exodus chapter 17, I want to read from the King James Version and starting in verse 1. Exodus chapter 17 and verse 1, and we'll read all the way down through I'll see where we read to. Starting in verse 1. And all the congregation of the children of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin after their journeys, according to the commandment of the Eternal, and pitched in Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink, and therefore the people did chide with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, why do you chide me? And why do you tempt the Eternal? And the people thirsted there for water. And the people murmured against Moses and said, well, wherefore is this that why have you brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst? And Moses cried unto the Eternal, saying, what shall I do unto this people? They are almost ready to stone me. Why are we here? This is not happening. This shouldn't be happening to me. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you of the elders of Israel and your rod, which you smote the river, and take it in your hand and go. And verse 6, behold, I will stand before you there upon the rock in Horeb, and you shall smite the rock, and there shall come out of it water that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the chiding of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us, or has he abandoned us? Then came Amalek after this. Notice right on the heels of this, and then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, choose us men and go out and fight with Amalek tomorrow. I will stand on top of the hill and with the rod of God in my hand. And so Joshua did as Moses had said to him and fought with Amalek, and Moses and Aaron and Hur went on top of the hill. And it came to pass when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let it down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy, and they took a stone and they put it under him, and he sat upon it. And Aaron and Hur stayed up the hands, and one on one side and one on the other, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua discomfited Amalek, his people, with the edge of the sword. And the Eternal said to Moses, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Yahweh Nissi, meaning the Lord is our banner. For he said, because the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. This is an interesting section of scripture here. And I want to bring out, I think I have 4 points here that I want to bring out here from the story. Point number one that I have is this. Notice this. Point number one is God himself led them to this place of suffering. God himself led them to this wilderness, as it was called. You see, God told them to set up a camp in this barren wasteland where there was no water, where there was nothing that would sustain life for them as far as they knew. And so Moses called the place Massah because it was here that the children of Israel had doubted God being brought to this place. I think of the story of Bill Cosby dropping his kids off. Why are we here? What are we doing here? They doubted their father. And they said, is God really here or has he abandoned us? I think that anyone that has a relationship with God can identify with the Israelites. We've all been there. And if we haven't, I think we'll all be there one day. You see, like others, I have asked the question of myself, has God abandoned me? And maybe you've asked the question of yourself too. I know that he promises he won't. I know that he says he'll be there. I know that he says he will complete the work that he says that he began in us, and he will complete that work. But knowing this hasn't prevented me from asking the question when suffering comes, my God, why have you forsaken me? I believe that each person must come to the point of answering the challenging questions in life. And I think the first of which is, does God exist? Is he there? But is he there when I need him also? Or has he abandoned me? And it can't simply be some academic exercise. It has to really be field tested. And God shows us how it is done with the various examples in the Bible of those who have come before us. We even see examples of others around us who have gone through trials, who've gone through sufferings, who've gone through tribulations contemporaneously to our own. At some point, however, God will lead us to a place that seems barren, and he will effectively say, now it's your turn. Now it's your turn, and we're going to see how you respond and how you react. You know, when a mother eagle determines that a young eagle is old enough to fly, she actually pushes the young out of the nest and forces it to test its wings, to try its wings. And unbeknownst to the young eaglet, the mother eaglet is there watching over it. But if something goes wrong and she feels like that eaglet's not going to make it, she swoops down underneath of it and she bears it up on her wings. If it's, for instance, fallen too far without flying, and she will bring that eaglet back up and dump it right back in the nest. And then she will begin again and she'll push that eaglet out of that nest again to test its wings. James chapter 1 speaks about trials and what God is accomplishing in us with them. You don't have to turn there, but James chapter 1 and verse 12, James writes this. Blessed is the man who endures temptation, because having been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord promised to the ones loving him. Now, this term enduring temptation, as it says here, blessed is the man who endures temptation, this term is the same sense of this little eaglet learning how to fly. You see, it's not just about, brethren, hunkering down and weathering the storm. It's not about finding a cave and going in that cave and hiding out in there and covering it up. There may be certain times in our life, in very brief moments, I think, where that's probably something we need to do. But that's not what this is talking about. It's not about going out and hiding ourselves and never coming out and saying, well, when everything is past, then I will come out and show myself. What he's talking about here, what James is speaking of here, is being approved in enduring temptation. The Greek word here for enduring is hupomeno, which isn't simply the ability to bear all things. That's not what it means. It's not just to simply to bear things. Instead, it's the quality which makes a person able not simply to suffer things, but to overcome them, to vanquish them. It's about facing them head on and dealing with them, and about not losing faith in what God is trying to accomplish in you and your life. So when God leads us to a place of suffering, believe that God is there and He has His watchful eye over us, and He won't turn away and look back and say, oops. The second point I have for this section is this. Number two is God led them into suffering while they were obedient to Him. God led them into suffering while they were obedient to Him. You know, even in obedience, there is much to be learned from suffering. Even when we're completely obedient to God, is it not written that Jesus learned from the things that He suffered? And here we have a perfect man. You see, being obedient and a godly individual really has nothing to do with whether you and I suffer. Oh, maybe sometimes it does, but not all the time. If anything, it's a guaranteed formula that we will suffer. So in many cases, asking the why questions really only frustrates us more. In the case of Job, God saw him as an upright man. He said, here I have an upright man and a righteous man. But due to a series of spiritual conversations that Job really had no knowledge of, that were occurring, without his understanding, he was thrust into this epic battle with the forces of darkness. And Job was being sifted as wheat. He was being sifted as wheat. And it wasn't till the end that he found the answers. But isn't that one of the lessons from Job? Is not becoming fixated on the why of suffering as opposed to trusting in God for our complete dependence. Now, we may not think that what we are going through is justified. And we may even think, well, there's a better way to do this. There's really a better way to accomplish it. Why did it have to happen this way? Why couldn't it happen some other way instead? Wouldn't there be a better way rather than this particular way that's going on? In reality, we always think there's a better way when there's suffering, when there's pain, even when there isn't. Even when Jesus prayed before his passion, what he said was, Father, he said, if there's any other way, he says, if there's any other way that you can accomplish what you are trying to accomplish, please do it. He said, even Jesus prayed that prayer. But he ended it with, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. In obedience, we may suffer through years of seeing, a spouse suffer through the end of their life. Now, everybody dies. It's appointed to man once to die. We're all going to lose our spouses at some point if time goes on. But to see a spouse suffer through years of dilemmas and problems, that's very tough on an individual, somebody that they've been married to for a very long time. It may be watching your child slowly taken away from you, as we saw, frankly, in Colombia with a couple. Their teenage child who was slowly taken away from them with a neurological disorder. For several years, they saw him slip away from them before he finally died. It could be the loss of a job. It doesn't really matter what it is. Even in obedience, God is creating a new individual in us. He's working this out. Number three is he ultimately gave, that is God ultimately gave them victory. But it was not without personal cost. Personal temporal cost. He gave them the victory, but it was not without personal cost. Though we know the victory over suffering is ours, we don't know how long it will last, and we don't know at what cost it will be. How many Israelites died in the battle that day with Amalek? How many mothers lost children that they didn't see, or husbands again? How many family members mourned that day? Jacob's cost was walking with a limp after wrestling with God. Job had new sons and daughters, and he lost his others. Paul had eye problems till the day he died. Peter was crucified. And many Christians, we know, were fed to lions. You see, the making of a son of God does not come easy. It's a difficult task. And it's a long and arduous and painful, and sometimes it's excruciating. But for such a difficult and a challenging task, only God has the understanding of how to make that happen. How is this going to work out? Only God understands the complexities of making this son of God, or this son of God. And number four is this: they didn't bear the sufferings and the burdens alone. This is a very important point. They didn't bear the sufferings and the burdens alone. The Israelites were in a barren place that God had deliberately led them, with no water, no food, in an army that was intent on destroying them. The Amalekites had attacked them, and their lives were being attacked on all fronts, physically, spiritually. They were being attacked. But it was the simple acts of each individual that brought them to a state of intimate worship with God. You see, as long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning the battle. As long as he was in supplication before God, they were able to prevail against the Amalekites. And finally, when Moses had become weary and he had no more strength in him and he could not hold up his hands, who did he have? He had his fellow Christians, as they were, his fellow friends that would got on one side and one on the other and held his hands up in supplication to God and supported him in leading the people to victory. And you realize, brethren, that only then was the battle won, when he had someone come in and help Moses and help him do that. That victory was won. Joshua, the brilliant general, he couldn't win the battle with his own strength and strategy alone. He had to know that Moses was doing his job. And when Moses couldn't do it alone, he, in his limited strength, he needed Aaron and Hur to support him. You know, God promises that he will give us a victory. And though you and I must battle with everything that is in us, God reminds us that ultimately the battle is not ours, it is his. It is his. And that you and I don't fight it alone. He didn't make us 1,000 churches of one, although we are getting close to that. He brought us together as a group. He gives us resources, just like Moses, in the form of family, in the form of friends, in the form of pastors, in the form of close friends who will provide tangible encouragement and comfort in the midst of the sufferings that we go through. And encouragement, as the word implies, endows us with courage to stand against the storm. And when we grow weary of lifting up our hands to heaven and our physical resources are drained, we have others that are able to do that on our behalf. And sometimes there are days when you just don't feel like doing anything. And there are times when your church family and your friends will lift you up in prayer to God on your behalf. And that will give you a respite. It'll give you a reprieve. So it will help you. Intercessory prayers of the saints go up for you and me constantly. And Jesus also, as we know, petitions the Father on our behalf. And he strengthens us, and he calms us, and he carries us when we need it. You see, God doesn't mean for us to just sit here in our suffering alone. He doesn't mean for us to just sit there and with no help from any place. Well, let's see how you do out there by yourself. That's not the intent or the purpose. He has given us the body of the church to, we know, to rejoice as one member, gives honor and praise, we all rejoice over that. And if one member of the body suffers, we all intercede on that person's behalf. So while there are many reasons that Christians suffer, it seems that God doesn't allow it seems that God doesn't always simply allow suffering in our lives. Rather, God has intended suffering to come to our lives. He's intended this to come to the ones whom he loves. In fact, the suffering that we see in Exodus chapter 17 leads me to ask if suffering is sometimes specifically designed for you and for me by God. Is it designed? That he actually brings you and me to the place of suffering in order to accomplish his purpose in us and to teach us something about him that we didn't know before, something that we didn't understand about him and something that we didn't understand about ourselves. Bill Cosby, thinking about this story again, Bill Cosby had concluded his story about his kids by noting that after he had dropped his kids off in front of the school, he saw them walk over and encircle their friends. And so they were all in this circle. And he got this thought, and he said, I put my car in park, pulled my keys out. He said, I walked over to that group of kids standing there with my kids, and he said, and I leaned down and I kissed every one of my kids on the cheek. And that threw them into a whole new suffering. You know, brethren, often it might be the simple kiss of God that we see as a trial when we really should look at it as joy. Even James wrote, count it all joy when you fall into these temptations. So rather than asking how a God who claims to love you and love me could allow us to suffer, we are actually more assured, more reassured by realizing that these things don't just happen. They don't just occur, but that this suffering is because he loves you. And that he saw no other way. He saw no other way to achieve what he wanted for you and for me. Now, knowing this doesn't necessarily remove the pain from suffering. But it should comfort us to know that since God brought us to this barren place, he is here with us and he will never leave us. And so, though we may ask the question in our suffering, just as King David did, where is God? The most comforting and logical conclusion is that God is here, and his handprints are on every part of our suffering. And he is not only intimately aware of it, but he is molding you and he's molding me for a grander purpose in his plan.